I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis. And this week, I'll be talking to George Eaton and Lucy Fisher about women in Parliament and the upcoming reshuffle. Kate Mossman will be talking to Mark Lawson about Monty Python and Arthur Miller. And Ian Steadman and I will be discussing the new surveillance laws. Next week, it's rumoured that the Tories will have a reshuffle. I'm joined by Lucy Fisher and George Eaton to look ahead to that and talk about the broader issue of women in Parliament. Lucy, first of all, you spoke to Yvette Cooper, who's Labour's Shadow Home Secretary this week, and she's been talking about a summer campaign about FGM, about violence against women. Why is she campaigning on explicitly kind of feminist themes at the moment?
I think she's just seen that under the current government, all these issues have really fallen by the wayside. From last week's Crown prosecution figures, we've seen that rape cases and child sex offences, the prosecutions and convictions are going down, and the sense that the police aren't looking at these cases, the authorities aren't caring about it enough, has prompted Labour's campaign.
And George, we're all on tenterhooks, I think is the only way to describe it, at the thought of a cabinet reshuffle before we go away for recess. Cameron's got a tough job because he knows he'll be criticised for the lack of women that he's got in his cabinet. I think it's now 4 full-time, 5 attending because of the way that that works. Who would you put money on to move up, shuffle up the ranks? And has he got a problem in that he's going to have to over-promote people who aren't ready?
Well, those I think you can expect to see move into the cabinet are Esther McVeigh, who's currently the employment minister, Liz Truss, who's currently minister at education. I think Nicky Morgan will be given a full post in the cabinet. She's currently financial secretary to the Treasury.
There was this great moment when she was made women's minister and then... Oh, no, Sayed Javid was made equalities minister and then it was realised that he was women's minister, so then they had to make a women's minister. And then it was realised that the women's minister still reported to a man. What a great day that
yes,
was.
Yes, no, it was even by sort of David Cameron's standards and standards of the coalition, it was a sort of classic omni-shambles moment. I mean, women more broadly. I mean, David Cameron set this target in opposition of having a third of ministers in his government as women, and he's not going to reach that target. He wants to get as close to it as possible. And part of the problem is that there's quite a limited pool for him to select from because the Tories only have 48 female MPs out of 306. And if you discount those who are already in the cabinet and government, those who've resigned or been sacked and who don't want to rejoin the government or who are focused on fighting to keep their seats, and those who perhaps aren't considered suitable for government, you're not left with a huge amount of people to choose from.
I find this absolutely fascinating because Cameron has several times has talked about this, and he's talked about the problem in selections, about the idea that they're looking for the perfect son-in-law, not necessarily the perfect candidate, about the fact that the selectors who work very hard are more likely to be, say, socially conservative than the population. So they like to be, I think the average age of someone in a conservative association is about 69. Matthew Parrish wrote a column at the weekend saying that one of the trouble is that women just aren't ballsy enough. I mean, how much credence do you give to that, Lucy, in the idea that women don't push themselves forward at selection meetings?
I think it's an interesting idea that women tend to be more balanced, perhaps more reasoned, as Matthew Paris pointed out. If they don't know the answer, they'll perhaps say that, whereas a man might be more ballsy and go ahead and aver an opinion. Even some of the women I hugely respect as being very confident and very outspoken in Parliament, such as Sarah Wollaston, you know, she's the first to say that she needed that call to arms from the Prime Minister to say to women, you know, you may not have gone to political meetings before, but have a go, stand to be an MP, you know, get involved in the selection process. So if even confident women need that encouragement, I think we're not seeing enough from the Conservative Party right now to encourage more women.
I have to say, I love Matthew Paris as a columnist, but I really disagreed with this one of his, because all the research showed, and we knew this when the Sheryl Sambo book came out, that confidence in women is not read universally positively. Where you might think that a guy sort of blustering through an answer is just him being, you know, kind of, well, he's, you know, he's having a go, he's, you know, he's, he knows his own mind, then you read that as kind of either shrillness or, you know, nagging in women, and those things can be very gendered, and there is a bigger problem. Ed Miliband's in a relatively luxurious situation, isn't he, George, because he's already got 14 women in the shadow cabinet. Might there be some more over the summer coming through?
Yeah, so Labour are not ruling a reshuffle in at the moment, but they're also not ruling one out, so they're keeping their options open. I don't think there are going to be any major changes. I mean, Ed Miliband has confirmed, for instance, that Ed Balls will remain Shadow Chancellor until the general election. He had quite a wide-ranging reshuffle, of course, last year. Tip that I have that has been made to me is that Lucy Powell, who is currently the shadow childcare minister and used to be Miliband's deputy chief of staff, will enter the shadow cabinet at some point, and Miliband's keen to get her in there before the general election.
And Lucy, what do you make of Harriet Harman's intervention last week? So she gave a speech in which she essentially said that she thinks that she was elected deputy leader of the Labour Party. If she'd been a man, she thinks she would have ended up being deputy prime minister under Gordon Brown. Was she rolling the pitch for criticising the other party or shoring up her own position?
I think probably she was doing both. It made her look very reasonable to criticise David Cameron by also criticising, you know, her former leader in the Labour Party. But also, it's a canny move in that it makes it very difficult for Ed Miliband not to select her as Deputy Prime Minister upon winning next year. So hats off to her on that one.
It's very difficult, though. I mean, if they go into coalition with the Lib Dems, they're going to have to offer, Nick Clegg, if he was still leader of the Lib Dems, is going to need a pretty sweet office of state. And I thought Deputy Prime Minister would have to go to him.
Yes, I mean, it partly depends, and I wrote about this a few weeks ago, whether the Lib Dems take the approach that they took last time, which is to have their leader or as deputy prime minister and able to range across all the departments, or whether to take on a few individual departments and to own those departments. And so for their leader to have a department of his own, I mean, say the Foreign Office or the Home Office. Labour figures have suggested to me in the past that Miliband's quite keen not to have the post of Deputy Prime Minister because it's excessive administrative cost. It's not necessary. But it will be hard, particularly because there are many in Labour, who, including Miliband, who emphasise the virtues of having a balanced team. It will be hard for him to argue that you shouldn't have at least, you know, one woman in one of the senior positions. And if it's not Chancellor, then Deputy Prime Minister is the next one.
And finally, George, one quick question on the NHS, which is Labour's big push over the summer. How much headway are they getting that? Are they just talking to their base who were going to vote Labour anyway? Are they winning any converts?
Well, I think there is a political interest for them in driving it up the agenda. And I think there are undoubtedly people who don't support them at the moment, but who do care a lot about the NHS. The key is for that, the future of the NHS, to become one of the defining questions at the election. Because if that's the case, then the answer in terms of who you vote for is more likely to be Labour, because people overwhelmingly think Labour would be the best party on the NHS. So according to the most recent YouGov poll, I mean, they lead by 12 points on the issue, which is a bigger lead than they have on any other. And so one shadow cabinet minister said to me this week, you know, after the economy, that's likely to be the top issue. We really need the NHS to be next, not immigration. I mean, they trail the Conservatives quite badly on immigration. So I think that is the aim for the summer, and I'd expect there'll be a big announcement at a conference in terms of providing the solution to some of the problems they've identified. As last year you saw, they spent the whole summer talking about cost of living, and then they came out with the energy price freeze at conference. I expect they'll do something similar on the NHS.
Well, in that case, we will look forward both to conference and to the reshuffle and pick those themes up next time. Thank you very much to Lucy and George. It was the night where everyone expected the Spanish Inquisition. Yes, Monty Python are back. Mark Lawson, our critic at large, has been to see them. Here he talks to arts editor Kate Mossman about what he expected and what he got.
Both, really. I went to the first one and I was very excited, and because it is so long. I mean, it's at least 25 years since they performed together. And so I had a real sense of excitement, but also combined with apprehension, because I think we have this. I think we always know that had they been, you know, were they ever to be possible, Beatles reunions, which now can't happen, or ABBA, there's just a terrible possibility of disappointment. Mm. I also, you know, you try to have some distance as a journalist. And even so, when the five surviving Pythons walked out at the beginning at the O2 in their tuxedos, it was genuinely thrilling and even slightly moving. And so I was quite surprised by that. I mean, it felt like a seriously big event.
Mm. And had you felt, I mean, was there pressure on them years back to do this? Or is it something that they've responded to because everybody else seems to be going on reunion tours, from, you know, rock bands to old acts like this getting back together?
Well, they've always been under pressure. I mean, I've, over the last 20 years or so, I mean, interviewed all the surviving ones separately and in odd combinations. And I always ended up saying, look, we've got to do this, you know, the ABBA or Beatles question. And they knew it was coming. And but they'd always, it was actually Michael Palin who always resisted on the interesting and rather impressive grounds that once Graham Chapman was dead, there could be no Python reunion.
Mm.
But again, I think an example of Michael Palin's famous kindness and niceness, which are genuine, because a couple of the others needed the money due to rearrangements in their personal lives, John Cleese and Terry Jones, it's well known, Palin agreed to do it. And again, it was impressive and moving that they found a way of solving the problem Palin had, because the scene changes are covered by the playing in of clips from the TV shows,
yes,
on giant screens. And so Graham Chapman is a very strong presence in the show. And so I think that's another impressive thing about it. So really, it is the six of them together.
Mm. That seems to be something that's happening more and more with, I know that Dweezil Zappa's show in honour of Frank Zappa now contains a giant pixelated version of Frank on a screen. And Freddie Mercury's soon going to be sort of beamed in the back of Queen shows as well. So in a way, It is fun, strangely moving, isn't it, when you see the...
It is. I used to worry about it because I thought it was quite mawkish. I think it depends how long they've been dead. I mean, I think if it's done too soon after their death, it just is quite upsetting.
Yes.
And makes you uneasy. But I think at this distance... I mean, the main problem with the whole thing, because I think I said moving or touching...
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
A couple of times now. I think that's a bit the problem, really, in that although Python was never politically radical, or, I mean, it was controversial, as we know from Life of Brian being banned, and it also depended on shock and surprise. I mean, their the sheer oddness of their sketches. I mean, the parrot sketch, or the philosopher's football team, or the Spanish Inquisition, they depend on surprise. And that's all gone. One of the most surreal experiences I've had was that what happens is that two actors who aren't the Pythons come onto stage, and they deliver a couple of lines of dialogue, which 20,000 people in the audience realize at the beginning of the Spanish Inquisition sketch. And I wrote in my notebook at that point, everyone expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Yes.
And it just seemed so, it just seemed a symptom of the problem with the whole enterprise, is that once people are expecting the Spanish Inquisition to burst into that suburban living room, then something has gone wrong.
And a certain coziness about the, I suppose, the atmosphere at these huge, these giant road shows that they began with Newman and Baddiel, didn't they, back in the early 90s? But that sense of a laugh of recognition echoing around this huge room kind of ruins the joke a lot of the time.
I think that is a problem. And I think you have to remember that, you know, and it wasn't just Mary Whitehouse, the morality campaigner. A lot of people hated Monty Python. I remember one of my grandfathers was vituperative about how stupid and pointless the whole thing was. And it was quite important that they were hated. There were people in the BBC who hated them and, you know, did everything they could to get them off air.
Mm.
And so you're right, to go into the O2 and this great bowl of warmth and love, I suspect that Cleese in particular would have found that quite, and Terry Gilliam would have found that very odd and difficult.
Thank you. The other thing that you've been to see for us recently was the parts of the Arthur Miller season. And most recently the Crucible, which I think is playing at the Old Vic. You make a very interesting point in your column this week that Miller was actually out of fashion for the last three decades of his career. Why was that? I mean, it seems so surprising now, considering, as you say, they're such topical, they remain such topical plays.
It was partly to do with modern medicine, I think, in that playwriting careers are very short. And on the whole, I mean, most playwrights have at most 10 years of success. Even Shakespeare wrote most of the great plays within a period of about 8 to 10 years. Chekhov wrote his four great plays within 7 years. Miller wrote his four masterpieces within the space of about 7-8 years. And in the past, certainly with Chekhov and Shakespeare, they conveniently died. Arthur Miller lived to the age of 90 and went on writing to the age of 90. But I think, rather more to his credit, he went out of fashion because he was such a severe critic of America. I mean, if you look at what those major plays are about, Death of a Salesman is a still stinging attack on capitalism's indifference to people.
Yes.
All My Sons is about corporate malfeasance. The Crucible is about mass hysteria, accusation, groupthink, you know, what we would say, some people now would call political correctness, the term wasn't used then. A View from the Bridge is about intolerance of immigrants. And so, you know, all of these critiques of America, which annoyed America and led to him not being staged there in the final years, final decades of his life, but he was taken up in Europe, and this has continued, really. It's a sort of unofficial Arthur Miller season, in that it just happens that the three theatres in London this summer have done three of the great plays. But a great privilege to see the three of them in a row. And
you drew some interesting parallels between the recent paedophile scandals in the Crucible, and this idea, a particular line that you picked out, you know, is the accuser always holy now? I thought that was a sort of, that line has a lot of resonance.
Yeah,
in recent
I mean, I expressed it carefully in the piece, and I'd express it carefully again. A chill went through the audience when John Proctor, the farmer who has been accused of, and his wife of, consorting with the devil, when that line was said, a genuine shiver went through the audience. And you do, you know, we have to be careful. Some clearly terrible and evil people have gone to jail in recent cases. On the other hand, there are a large number of other cases in which juries have not found the evidence compelling, or the cases have never reached caught that people's finances and reputation have been destroyed. I mean, I thought particularly of the Nigel Evans case, the Deputy Speaker of the House of Commons, in which he was cleared in court. A number of the so-called victims had not even wanted the case to be brought against him and made that clear. And yet his reputation and his finances have been destroyed. And I think great plays take on the meaning of the time that they're in which they're staged.
Yes.
And I think that's clearly true with the Crucible. I mean, it's interesting because it happened to open on Thursday, which was the night before Rolf Harris was sentenced. Yes. And as I say, I mean, no, I think nobody really can argue with what happened in that case. But on the other hand, it was also the beginning of this great wave of, you know, what may turn out to be hysteria about alleged paedophilia in Westminster. And I think Miller has a lot to say about that, because I think in the media, in certain companies, HR departments, and in the CPS, there sometimes does seem to be a feeling that accusation is fact. And I think that gives the player tremendous power.
Yes. Thank you so much. Is the Old Vic's production is presumably still running for a little while of The Crucible. Is it on this summer?
Yes. Which is great. Because it actually is. I'm happy to say it's one of the best productions I've ever seen of, I think, one of the greatest plays ever written. And it's on until September the 23rd.
Thursday, 10th of July, the government announced new surveillance legislation, the so-called DRIP laws, which allow them to store information for longer. I'm joined by our tech writer, Ian Steadman. So first of all, what's behind this? Why suddenly did this come out?
Well, this goes back to 2006, when the EU said that national governments within the EU could collect all kinds of metadata about citizens. And that was really regarding phone calls and stuff like that. So it would be not a recording of anyone's phone calls, but a recording of
who you called and how long you called them for, how many times you called them in a month.
Yeah. And that was all fine and dandy as far as the security services were concerned. And then in April this year, the Attorney General of the EU said, hang on, that directive is actually in violation of the EU Charter on Fundamental Human Rights. And so retroactively, we have to kind of change the law. And that caused particularly some governments, particularly the British government, to freak out a bit, because it meant that all their very comprehensive surveillance apparatus was in violation of EU law. There was a judicial review that is currently waiting to go. And this law that was announced today is in response to the April ruling, where they basically want to pass a law to preempt the removal of the directive.
So they're going to rush this through extremely fast. Yeah. The legislation is coming through next week. It looks like they pretty much sewn it up, the three parties together.
It's very much keeping things kind of, some things are the same, some things are different. Labour and the Lib Dems, I mean, first of all, we have to recognise that Labour were very happy with this arrangement in the first place, and the coalition has just continued it. But
it's a surprise from the Lib Dems, though, isn't it? Because they were against what they called the so-called Snoopers Charter.
This
they
is
are
very
fundamentally
similar to it.
The party of civil liberties. Yeah.
The Snoopers Charter, as proposed by Theresa May, the fundamental part of that was that all metadata would be that's generated in the UK, even if a company like, say, Google, is outside the UK. Anyone who's inside the UK who uses their service, their metadata has to be stored within the UK and within access, like people with the police or whoever can access it within the UK. But that same requirement is in this new law. So it's the same as the Snoopers Charter, the whole 12 months thing. It's just that it's there's going to be a US style oversight committee, which is like the one that the NSA has.
It's like the FISA courts.
Yeah, which famously doesn't really do anything.
And you can't find out what they do because it's all secret anyway. I mean, this is part of the justification this time is given as being a terrorist threat, people leaving to go and become jihadis in Syria, paedophilia, and sort of nebulous criminality.
Yes, as is the first two aren't also included in that blanket term of criminals.
So from my point of view, it just seemed to be that the government rolls through emergency legislation to counter a specific threat, whether or not that threat later turns out to be overblown. And it never gets around to going, which, because it's very hard to say, oh well, terror threat over now. Everything's definitely fine and definitely nothing bad will happen.
A key thing about this is that it has a sunset clause. At the end of 2016, it expires and there has to be a debate over maintaining it or just letting it fall out of enforcement or whatever. I don't know how to describe a law, but
it's impossible, though, isn't it? I mean, you saw the same thing about the knife crime thing, and it was, you know, the Lib Dems made a stand over that, but you will never lose votes by being mean to criminals,
and David Cameron has specifically come out and said that he doesn't want to be the prime minister who has to go on TV after a terrorist attack and say, I could have done more, but I didn't stop it, which is there's that whole thing about if you want to give him a little security, you don't deserve liberty.
Yeah.
But
deserves neither, yeah.
I think all three main political parties are very much on the more security, please sort of side of that argument.
Do you think there is likely, I know there have been a lot of anger about it in the kind of free internet bits of the internet, if you see what I mean, but do you think there is anything that will happen, or is it just an unstoppable juggernaut that's going there?
Well, parliamentary-wise, all three parties support it, and it is going to be passed, short of anything amazing happening between now and... it's going to be debated very quickly on Tuesday and then passed on Thursday. But the fact is that the directive that enabled this kind of mass surveillance was ruled illegal by the Attorney General of the EU. That hasn't changed. So even though the original law that was passed in response to the 2006 announcement is, you know, that is going to be, that was going to be repealed under judicial review, this appears like it should be vulnerable to the same kind of judicial review. So maybe they're just trying to postpone it and knock it down the line a bit.
Or maybe someone's got a hope that we won't be part of the European Convention on Human Rights.
Maybe, yes. That is also something, yeah.
Well, we'll keep an eye on this story, and thank you very much, Ian. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast. You can find us every week on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast. Our theme tune is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons, and our producer is Philip Maughan.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.